This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
On the grill this morning, a person that we know quite well at BFM, Johan Merican, formerly of Talent Corp, and now you are the Director of National Budget Office at the Ministry of Finance. Johan, welcome back to BFM. Interesting, well, pivot in terms of position, but explain to us your role at the National Budget Office at the MOF. Clearly, it seems from the outset, at least superficially, that you've got quite a lot of power and autonomy in terms of deciding who gets the goodies and how much, right?
Good morning, Chuang, and thank you so much for having me back on BFM. It's nice to see your new offices as well. Well, I'm now at the Ministry of Finance, and as you rightly said, Director of Budget. So my role on a day-to-day basis is really in terms of helping the allocation of expenditure between the different ministries. I'm not really sure I would describe myself as powerful. Really, there is a chain of command. Ultimately, the minister, the SecGen, deputy SecGen. So you know, there's really I'm part of the process, part of the team that works on the national budget. One, in terms of my department, in terms of the expenditure, but also in terms of helping in terms of the preparations for the minister's speech as well.
Yeah, so can you break down, Johan, the mechanics of how your office works in terms of how in terms of hierarchy with Guaning and the SecGen as well, and discuss basically tell us how you manage your office and how you contribute to this equation.
Well, we're not structured not differently from many ministries. I mean, ultimately, the minister is the approving authority. And the Secretary General obviously then manages the ministry. Mine is one of the few departments under what we call the policy wing of the Ministry of Finance, where also under the policy wing, I have my colleagues who work on fiscal, who cover the debt and deficit levels, and they determine that level. And I also have colleagues in the tax department who also work on the tax measures. My department focuses more on the expenditure side of it.
Okay, so that's the easier part because you get to spend, right? So your overarching vision under the NBO, National Budget Office, says you are to formulate an efficient and effective budgeting system to meet the requirements of the national economy. Explain to us the methodology of doing so and what kind of countervailing factors also enter the equation.
I think when you look into, for example, the process of preparing the 2020 budget, I think first it gets guided, I think, by the leadership. And as you're aware, Budget 2020, in terms of our theme of driving growth and equitable outcomes towards the shared prosperity, that really provides first the high-level anchor. We really want to ensure that as directed by at least the leadership, the Prime Minister, our Minister of Finance, we really are trying to then, first, it was intended to be one, a growth-centric a budget, but at the same time, one that also gives due focus towards addressing some of the development gaps as in line with the spirit of the shared prosperity. From that high level, we then marry that with the various requests that come to us from the many ministries. To some extent, a lot of government expenditure is locked in. You know, more than 85% of our operating expenditure is locked in. You know, by virtue of you know emoluments, long-term contracts. But there's obviously that room to play with in terms of looking at really what, how can we ensure that the programs that are then undertaken by the various ministries then support those broad, overarching themes that the government basically is trying to achieve.
Well, you're recently new in the post, and I presume the NBO, the budget office, has been around since time immemorial. So one gets the sense that in the past, budgets are made, you know, even down to households, budgets are made, and how well they're kept to it or adhered to is of paramount importance. But in the past, Malaysia has been going back to Parliament for supplementary budgets every single year since at least 1998, 1999. So what have you done to rejuvenate the office, and what has been done wrong in the past?
I think there are a couple of things that were introduced by both at the minister level and also by our SecGen in terms of looking at the budgets going forward. I think one of the things that, particularly with the new government coming in, one of the things that they particularly highlighted was this issue that we tend to very much approach on, you know, using what corporates say, very much on an incremental a budget process, where it's very much what was done last year and then maybe just add on a X percent.
So kind of like a control C, control V thing. Right? Control all, control C, then control V. Was that very much the case in the past?
That perhaps sounds bad, but you know, perhaps you know, it's not that far off. Perhaps from that.
They tweak the mechanism, right?
I think one of the things that we start looking at, and this is something that also was initiated by Tan Sri Ismail, formerly Ministry of Finance Secretary, now Chief Secretary. He initiated this idea of really needing to look at, for example, a zero-based budgeting. I think one of the things that he had from his experience in being a SecGen at different ministries was there's always this differentiation. If it was a program that was existing, it was almost like assumed to be continued. And if it was a new program, then it was subject to greater scrutiny. So I think one of the things that we now focus on is all programs, whether they're proposed new or have been there running for many years, would then basically apply the same level of review. Because in many cases, perhaps some of the things that have been running for a very long time really need to be looked again and rationalised.
Well, the problem with that kind of template-based approach is that if it was flawed initially, then it continues to be flawed over the long term. And, you haven't really answered the question, Johan, in terms of why Malaysia keeps on going back for supplementary budgets in the first quarter of the new year, every single year, for at least the last 21 years.
No, certainly. And I don't think it's unusual, if you look at
but if budgeting
corporate sector.
If budgeting was done right, then you wouldn't need to go back for more money.
No, there's always going to be unexpected events. There are always certain things that would happen, which, and I think it's not, unusual to have a supplementary. The issue is to what percentage or to what scale it has happened. I think, you know, we did not have like two supplementaries last year. I mean, we had one. Some of the items that really came out in the supplementary budget, particularly the one that was tabled under the new government, really were some contingencies that were not foreseen when they first came in. I think you will have some degree of supplementaries, but I think we can be assessed perhaps looking at what's the percentage amendments based on the original budget.
Well, we do know that budgets can be highly politically expedient and they are oftentimes used as a tool to curry favour with stakeholder groups. The things we want to ask you also, Johan, how you allocate funds to various states. For example, when it comes to Sarawak, they got 4.5 billion ringgits for this current budget. And how do you justify this given, you know, other states that are in need of such, in fact, equivalent funds, for example, Kelantan, Terengganu. What kind of factors enter your mind when you come to saying State A gets this and State B gets that?
So actually, maybe just I should clarify in terms of the way that we allocate budgets. We don't start off from saying, okay, these are the states and this is the amount we want to allocate to the particular state. Actually, ours tend to be quite a bottoms-up and it comes from individual ministries' requests. And so based on what each relevant ministry. So you have, you know, Ministry of Education might be asking for schools in Sarawak. Ministry of Rural Development will be asking for example, rural electrification. We tend to assess them at the merits of the projects at each individual ministry. And then later on, when it then gets consolidated up, then perhaps we produce our analysis by state. But, you know, I must confess that we don't really start off saying, oh, we have a certain target for a particular state and then we basically like massage it to reach it there. It's really anchored on the individual projects that basically are anchored by individual ministries. But having said that, you would expect that, particularly in terms of Sabah and Sarawak, to continue to be the states to receive the highest development expenditure. I think particularly on the infrastructure, they continue to be behind the rest of Malaysia. And so why there is perhaps a higher allocation towards them is that, you know, for example, the Ministry of Rural Development, the majority of allocation for rural roads, which is, you know, a billion, majority of that goes to Sabah Sarawak. Rural electrification, rural water, those also majority would go to Sabah Sarawak. There's a special focus, for example, even for this year, for the Ministry of Education, looking at what we call the dilapidated schools. You know, you'd be surprised, in Sabah Sarawak, we still have schools in wooden structures. And so that certainly is something that, you know, I think many Malaysians would accept as probably not acceptable in this day and age. So, you know, special focus to then also try to replace and rebuild some of these dilapidated schools. So I think it's not unusual that there is this focus on Sabah Sarawak.
Correct, but it's also no coincidence that Sabah Sarawak, in combination, offer a high number of parliamentary seats for come election time. And you would also say that by comparison, Kelantan Terengganu also has the highest levels, one of the highest levels of poverty and illiteracy in the country versus Sabah Sarawak. So, I mean, given those countervailing factors, to an extent, is political expediency enter the equation?
You know, when we look at it, I mean, particularly at the budget office, I mean, we really look at it based on analysing the requests of ministries and look at it based on its merits.
And then does it go higher up to the SecGen, then to the FinMin, finance minister, to then decide, okay, this goes or this doesn't go? And how much pushback is there from the finance minister?
I think typically a lot of the details really are done at the civil service level in terms of the individual allocation to projects, in terms of the allocation to ministries. I think where the guidance comes from the minister and particularly this particular year, we did had quite a robust debate internally, particularly with regards to the level of deficit. And as you may recall, in Budget 2019, the government announced a commitment to target 3.0% deficit. And it was very much guidance by both Cabinet and also our Yang Berhormat Minister of Finance, Mr. Lim Guan Eng, to then basically say that, given the current global circumstances, increasing uncertainties, and also in terms of outlook for the coming year, it was at the ministers and the Cabinet level that then decided that we really should ease up on our earlier target of 3.0, and therefore you see a deficit of 3.2% for 2020. So there was basically an easing, which was very much directed by leadership. The view was that it was important to have perhaps a more preemptively expansionary budget for 2020.
We're talking this morning to Johan Merican, the Director of the National Budget Office at the Ministry of Finance. After this, Johan, we're going to come back and get into the specifics of various stakeholder groups, including the property sector and the B40s, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
This morning we have Johan Merican, the Director of the National Budget Office at the Ministry of Finance, on the grill with us. Now, in terms of how you measure allocations and efficient expenditure of that, for example, the Education Ministry this year received 65 billion ringgit, the highest out of all the ministries. Given where the Education Ministry's performance has been in the last few years, Johan, where did you find it within yourselves to say, well, this ministry needs much, much more money than ever before? And on what metrics are they then measured KPI-wise?
I think certainly, even in Budget 2019, the same applies for Budget 2020, even if there was a need to rationalise anywhere, I think the government recognises that human capital and education remains a topmost priority, and there's certainly no discussion of wanting to reduce, and therefore you continue to increase. We see the increase from 2019 of 60 billion up to 64 billion. So that's one part of it.
No question. But in terms of how it's performed and how it's done, it's not really an allocation. One gets a sense it's not an allocation or expenditure level issue. It's one which is basically in terms of how it's mapped out and how it's expended, which is the issue. We have 500,000 unemployed, of which 300,000 are unemployed graduates of 24 years and below, half of which are basically those with tertiary degrees. So something's wrong with the system. Something's wrong with the ministry. It's not a expenditure issue. It's a substantive issue.
I think there's a recognition that there's certainly a need for reform. I think whether, even previously there were blueprints, and I think to some extent a new government has come in and revisited those blueprints in terms of what is then the direction for reform. Certainly in terms of metrics of having to look at employability, not too long ago, many universities would then say, employability is not my job. I'm just here to educate, or whatever that would mean, without applying for employability. But certainly, employability KPIs are now set for all the public universities. But even recognizing that there is really an issue, I think that's why you do see this Nations at Work initiative announced by the government in this 2020 budget. I think it's a recognition that there is an issue. I know we often like to say that, Malaysia is at full employment, we have 3% unemployment, but we know that at the youth below 25, it's, more than 10%, and amongst graduates, a subset of that is even reaching 18%. So we recognise there is an issue, hence the need to then take not just short, long-term reform, but also short-term measures to immediately address it?
Well, as of 2018, there's 140,000 graduates below the age of 24 who are basically holding university degrees, who don't have a job. Now, there's something obviously wrong with the system. And if you offer financial incentives to the, you know, 500 ringgit a month of 24 months to employers to hire graduates who have been unemployed for more than a year, that doesn't hit the heart of the problem. The heart of the problem is that they're not studying the right things. Now, whether it's from the budget office or whether it's from the education ministry, someone's got to substantively look at the issue and analyse what's going wrong.
So I think there's been countless issues looked at it in terms of where's the mismatch, and there are certainly efforts being done by the ministry to now look at scaling down particularly courses which are then less relevant, introducing new elements to curriculum. Another big push by the ministry is to enhance industry collaboration. You know, you do see now industry players being brought in onto the boards of various universities. Like, for example, the chairman of University Science Malaysia is a former CEO of Motorola. You know, so there's basically a move towards how to ensure that there's greater industry relevance. But at the same time, coming back to the nations at work, now, whilst it may just seem to be giving a subsidy or an incentive, what we do find that in many cases, our young graduates need experience. And we've done various programs like it where we provide basically assistance to start a young fresh graduate into work, you know, giving them 1 to 2 years work experience. And that in itself helps bridge the gap between what they've been taught in university and what's required at the workplace. And many of those who then go through that find that it's much easier for them to get subsequent work or get retained in their employment. And maybe that also comes back to a lot of our graduates not doing very well in the interview or job hiring process. And sometimes given that bit of a leg up, when given an opportunity to prove themselves, they then, A, are able to prove themselves. And number two, also really learn hands-on on the job, really what industry requires.
I'm talking this morning to Johan Merican, the Director of the National Budget Office at the Ministry of Finance. We are discussing the mechanics of Budget 2020 and how they're allocated specifically. Now, this question just came in literally seconds ago, Johan, from a person named Pham. And I think this is quite apt where we are in terms of discussion. Asking, we'd like to have more transparency, I presume, from the public, more transparency in terms of what's been spent and allocation. None of the ministries publish in a detailed manner. Do you think this is necessary, and will you address this, especially from the budget office?
You know, we certainly are quite transparent in terms of all the allocations that are spent by all the ministries, in terms of how it's allocated, what we then produce every year. Perhaps not the most riveting read, but it's quite a thick tome which basically sets out by each ministry the categories of their allocation in terms of type of expenditure, and in terms of the development expenditure project, there's even a list in terms of, at least admittedly at the high level, but at least sets out all the different projects that we allocate towards. And subsequently, you know, in terms of our fiscal report, we then an economic outlook, we then basically really set out in terms of performance of expenditure against previous year. You know, we readily admit that perhaps there are areas to improve in terms of transparency. And I think one step taken by the new government was the formation of the Select Committee on Budget. And there, I dare say, under the leadership of Datuk Sri Mustafa Mohamad, I think the most active parliamentary Select Committee, they actively meet up with us regularly to review and look at the previous budgets. And we continue to engage with them actively. They've already published one report on the debt and liability position, and we continue to engage them in terms of expenditure performance. So I think that's one of the steps in the right direction.
And yet from an actionability perspective, every year the Auditor General comes up with a report, and this is not a broad-based an audit. It's a very targeted audit, and they can't capture everything. Yet the Auditor General finds omissions and fiscal mismanagement in most ministries, but notably in, for example, things like in defence typically, and in finance typically, and in terms of procurement typically, right? There are things, and there are considerable things that fall between the cracks, and this happens every single year. How will that change under your stewardship?
I mean, one way of, you know, there's always glass half full, glass half empty, and I think the glass half full part is that, you know, the government, you know, does consistently, you know, make public the Auditor General report, and, you know, all ministries are tasked to really take action on any issues that are raised.
So how much action has been taken, because Auditor General every year comes up with such omissions?
You know, they continue to be areas to improve. I think that applies every year. But certainly, I think certainly under the new government, there's certainly an impetus to really look at how to then really address some of the, particularly on the governance issues and processes, particularly in terms of procurement.
Okay, when it comes to specific stakeholders, for example, the B40s is one area that the budget looks very, very closely at. You say, I think you've been quoted as saying that this budget narrows the gap in terms of development gaps and assisting disadvantaged groups like the women, the disabled and the SMEs. One overarching issue, and this is said in the 2030 Shared Prosperity Vision, the Bumiputra agenda is in every single thrust. But there are many other specific racial groups, much smaller than the Bumiputra, like the Indians, for example, who continue to be marginalized and basically sit on the fringes where incomes and livelihoods and literacy is concerned. But not much. Typically, every single budget, there's not much is set aside for the Indian minority. And why is that the case?
I don't think that's necessarily fair. I think even under the current government, we've been setting aside one under the entity Mitra, which is under the Prime Minister's department. It's been, you know, placed under the Prime Minister's department. We've allocated last year in 2019 and, sorry, next year in 2020, 100 million for that particular entity to do specific programs for the Indian community in terms of whether it's training, community development programs. In addition, we also have these microcredit facilities, for example, under Tekun, who provided 20 million in this year's budget. So certainly there are specific programs for the Indian community. Perhaps we've not listed out all of them. And you know, even under different communities, the Orang Asli, obviously another community where we've set aside you know, more than 100 million for JAKWA, the department that looks after the agency in terms of ensuring, again, help raising income, raising, you know, infrastructure. So I think, you know, within the breadth there is in government, certainly there is an attempt to look at really all groups that perhaps are potentially disadvantaged to assist.
Yes, but one gets a sense of, I mean, I'm sure you can't give me specifics, Johan, but can you recall in broad-based terms how much money has been specifically set aside for the Orang Asli community and the Indian community versus what has been set aside specifically for the Bumiputra community?
Okay, so as I could at least give a couple of examples in terms of the Indian community, the 100 million under Mitra and the 20 million under the microcredit. For JAKWA, which is our department looking after Orang Asli, from recollection, I believe the allocation is around 140 million. A big portion of it is we look at assistance. So one part that we look at, a big portion of assistance that goes to the Orang Asli is in terms of education assistance because they're quite dispersed. And so we even fund, for example, the cost of transporting them to schools, food, and also in terms of sometimes if they do need to stay in boarding facilities. That's one part of the assistance. Basic infrastructure continues to be a special focus. It's given a special allocation for Orang Aslis in terms of ensuring that their communities are also enhanced in terms of basic
facilities. So in umbrella terms, how much money has been set aside for Orang Asli and how much has been set aside for the Indian community? And versus what has been set aside for the Bumiputra community? Do you have those numbers? In broad-based terms? And I think more specifically as well, do you also measure the impact of these allocations in terms of impact to them? For example, employment numbers, for example, literacy numbers.
No, but when you look at...
These are very apt, because when you talk about the disadvantage, these are the most disadvantaged groups in the country.
Okay, but when you look at things like literacy in terms of education outcomes or even welfare, they are applied to all irrespective of race. So, for example, even when government introduces Bantuan Sara Hidup,
but the politicians have admitted that these are race-based, you will continue to entertain a race-based policy.
No, so even say, for example, for Bantuan Sara Hidup, there's no race in the forms and it's provided to all based on income levels without even looking at the group. So in that sense, the welfare programs are done even without reference to race. And that continues to be the case that if they're for the poor, they're for the poor, irrespective of race. So I think that's also important to take into account that, you know, there's some colorblind, you know, particularly in terms of incentives targeted in terms of welfare-oriented programs.
We're talking this morning to Johan Merican, the Director of the National Budget Office at the Ministry of Finance. We'll come back after the news and extend the grill to 8:45 and we'll get into specific other areas like, for example, property and the women's at work. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
This morning in the grill, I am talking to Johan Merican, the director of the National Budget Office at the Ministry of Finance. And Johan, just as we left it before the news, just one more comment on the issue, as budget allocations go and their political expediency of them, allocations among the country's people and along race lines, as budgets typically are, one gets a sense that as their numbers diminish, whether it's the Indian minority or even the Chinese minority or even the Orang Asli minority. As their numbers diminish and as their political influence diminish along with their voter base, their financial allocations also diminish. Now, in terms of what you do at the budget office, what is the constructive way forward? Perhaps where impact is concerned, where precise allocations are concerned, and precise where impact is concerned, can you send messages on?
No, I just wanted me to come back to the point. So even for the Orang Asli, which you would argue has, you know, relatively smaller voice, whether it's in terms of parliament or cabinet,
I think it's a vastly smaller voice.
Government continues to ensure that there is still a consistent allocation that goes in to ensure that their communities, you know, out of the 140 million I mentioned earlier, you know, more than 80 million is actually allocated for development projects, as I said, to try to do, you know, basic infrastructure to make sure they're not left behind. Coming back to the Indians, whilst you do see, it may seem modest having a specific allocation of only 100 million for under Mitra and the Prime Minister's department. I do believe that we certainly have more voice for the Indian community today, particularly if you look at the cabinet, certainly a lot more members of cabinet from Indian community who then also lend their voice to ensure the community is safeguarded. In addition to that, many of our programs, in terms, for example, for some of our training programs, while it is not specifically allocated by ethnic groups, we do have, for example, some TVET programs which are targeted, say, for example, communities who are in, you know, estates, in rural areas, in terms of some of the poor, urban poor housing areas. And, you know, some of these maybe would have certain demographics within to some communities, but certainly the target is really looking at based on need. And I think, you know, we at the budget office will continue to focus, you know, particularly given the background of the shared prosperity vision outlined by the Prime Minister, to really focus on need and ensuring that assistance is provided. And I think for the Indian community, you know, a lot of this human capital development is quite important, you know, particularly in terms of the youth. I think that's one area that's been identified in terms of ensuring that they are suitably skilled and gainfully employed. And I think that will probably be one area that we'll continue to give some specific focus to.
To what extent does your office perform postmortems on budgets gone by? For example, when you set aside money for various races, for example, do you perform postmortems on their employability, on their employment status, in terms of their household incomes, in terms of their literacy rates? Do you do that at all or no?
So when we look at the budget book that adds sets out all the allocations by the different ministries. Each ministry, the preamble actually starts off with what are the key targets and goals that the ministry sets out to achieve with its allocation. And as part of the annual process, the subsequent year, we then do, you know, in terms of our engagement with the respective ministries when they ask for the subsequent year's budget, to basically see, compare it against how have they performed against their, well, KPIs, if you could call it that. Certainly, there's room for improvement just looking from high-level KPIs. I think one of the areas which even the minister perhaps has also given some guidance is looking at what's the cost per person to deliver a certain type of assistance. And for example, in an earlier review, you know, for example, TVET is an area that the government wants to give focus. And right now, the TVET education, vocational education, is spread over different ministries. It's not just in the Ministry of Education, it's in the Ministry of Human Resources, Ministry of Youth and Sports, and also under MARA. And we see that the cost of educating a particular individual, say up to diploma or SKM, the cost per person varies by different ministries. And also employability varies. And I think that's one area that perhaps we can then further tighten the governance or allocation according to performance, especially when we have comparators that differ across different agencies.
Going to your Graduates at Work initiative, I think from a superficial perspective, it's quite laudable. And it does make financial sense for employers to do that. But of course, it's encountered some criticism from the Malaysian Employers Federation, Dato' Shamsuddin Badan, as well as MP Wong Chen, YB Wong Chen, saying that they could create some kind of an inertia among graduates to stay unemployed for over a year and then deploy those incentives. What do you think of those? How would you comment?
I know I've received comments suggesting that when you create incentives, people will purposely not be employed. I think that's pretty unrealistic. I think anyone who's really been in the job market would know that the longer you are unemployed, the likelihood or ability for you to get employment does reduce. And even when the government has highlighted these financial incentives, I do believe they're more really at a tipping point incentives. No employer, I think, would just employ someone just because they're getting incentive, partly because, you know, there are a lot of responsibilities, you know, in particularly in Malaysia with, you know, labour laws and obligations of an employer. No one's going to just employ someone just because there's an incentive. But we do hope that with this incentive, and I think it's often the case that as employers, sometimes, you know, when we interview or assess a candidate and we're not completely sure, we hope that helps as a tipping point to then give the employer perhaps a feeling that they can perhaps give more just an opportunity to try them out, and also give the opportunity to those individuals to really prove themselves. And I think a lot of young Malaysian graduates do say that, you know, they find, you know, struggle wanting to get that first opportunity, because in many cases, a lot of job advertisements always say they want experience. And sometimes how do you get them that first opportunity? And hopefully through this program, we give them at least the first opportunity to get their first work experience, which then puts them in a good stead going forward.
Yeah, Johan, we're nearly out of time. So I just want to get your views on the property sector. You've been quite vocal in being quoted where lowering the property threshold for foreign buyers from 1 million to 600,000. You said it's a short-term measure to clear the overhang. This sends messages that the planning where property market was concerned was basically quite poor in the past. And it's also a nod to property developers who are, for the most part, very influential in lobby terms with the government.
I think there are certainly challenges in terms of property planning in Malaysia, particularly it's effectively decentralized down to the, you know, state and, you know, local authority level. And I think what now we do see is certainly a situation where we have a significant level of unsold stock. And I think the government, Ministry of Finance, took a view that it's in certainly not anyone's interest, the economy particularly, to have a continued situation of unsold stock, and felt it was in terms of a reasonable or step to take to reduce the threshold for foreign ownership. Because, you know, these are, after all, stock which were not sold. And if we then allow for this window of next year, particularly those who are, you know between that range now, brought down to 600,000, at least enables some of that stock to be released, and hopefully then, you know, with good spillovers back to the economy.
Yeah, Johan, intriguing last question for you. Where you allocate budgets for ministries, how would you allocate appropriately and efficiently for your own Ministry of Finance and even for your department? Who budgets for the budget officer?
Well, okay, well, you perhaps would not believe that it could be done in a way that's necessarily independent, but certainly there is a separation. There is a different part of Ministry of Finance that makes the application for its allocation. And
the so-called Chinese wall.
Yes, it's a different part of the Ministry of Finance, and we as the budget office, you know, scrutinize it as best we could. And certainly we think that, you know, we act judiciously in comparison to all ministries.
Yeah, just to wrap up, one gets a sense that the budget office and basically how national budgets are allocated needs reform of a material kind. And I know how difficult it is for governments to reform. As you say it offline, it's easier to rewrite the rule book than to amend the rule book. Just to send a constructive message, how will you amend the process going forward, Johan? Clearly, material adjustment is needed.
No, certainly, the leadership has set out a clear need for reform, whether from the Prime Minister down to our own Minister of Finance on the need to reform. I think certainly there have been changes that have already been implemented at the Ministry of Finance. I think this particular year's budget also was, I think, quite notable. I think a much higher level of stakeholder engagement. There's actually a number of measures that were actually taken from public and also stakeholder input, even like things like, for example, EPF withdrawals and tax relief on fertility treatment was actually what some of those that came from public feedback. Actually, there are over like 20 measures included in this year's budget that actually came from inputs, which I think was quite different from past experience. So I think there is definitely a greater level of openness to suggestions and criticism, and I think that's probably the way forward in terms of then improving ourselves.
Of course, all journeys of a large nature always begin with a single step. So thank you for talking with us and for sharing your thoughts, Johan. I was talking to Johan Merican, the Director of the National Budget Office at the Ministry of Finance, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, Frost & Sullivan's Malaysia Mobile Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.